official. "What about children?" my sister Gretchen asked, slipping a tab of acid under her tongue. "Can I not marry and still have a baby?" I imagined the child, his 15 hands batting at the mobile hanging over his crib. "Sure, you can still have kids. Now just pick up your eyebrow pencil and sign on the dotted line." My fear was that, once married, my sisters would turn their backs on the family, choosing to spend their vacations and holidays with their husbands. One by one, they would abandon us until it was just me and my parents, eating our turkey and stuffing off TV trays. It wasn't difficult getting the signatures. The girls in my family didn't play house. They played reformatory. They might one day have a relationship. If it happened, it happened, but they saw no reason to get bent out of shape about it. My father thought otherwise. He saw marriage as their best possible vocation, something they should train for and visualize as a goal. One of my sisters would be stooped before the open refrigerator, dressed in a bathing suit, and my father would weigh her with his eyes. "It looks like you've gained a few pounds," he'd say. "Keep that up and you'll never find a husband." Find. He said it as though men were exotic mushrooms growing in the forest and it took a keen eye to spot one. "Don't listen to him," I'd say. "I think the weight looks good on you. Here, have another bowl of potato chips." Marriage meant a great deal to our neighbors as well, and we saw that as another good reason to avoid it.
"Well, we finally got Kim married off."
This was always said with such a sense of relief you'd think the Kim in question was not a 20-year-old girl, but the last remaining puppy of an unwanted litter. Our mother couldn't make it to the grocery store and back without having to examine wallet-sized photos of someone's dribbling, pop-eyed grandbaby. "Now that's different," she'd say. "A living baby. All of my grandchildren have been ground up for fertilizer or whatever it is they do with the aborted fetuses. It puts them under my feet but keeps them out of my hair, which is just the way I like it. Here's your picture back. You tell that daughter of yours to keep up the good work." Unlike our father, it pleased her that none of her children had reproduced. She used the fact as part of a routine she delivered on a regular basis. 6 children and none of them are married. I've taken the money we saved on the weddings and am using it to build my daughters a whorehouse." After living with her boyfriend Bob for close to 10 years, my sister Lisa nullified our contract when she agreed to marry him. Adding insult to injury, they decided the wedding would take place not at a drive-through chapel in Las Vegas, but on a mountaintop in western North Carolina. "That's nice," my mother said. "Now all I need is a pair of navy blue hiking boots to match my new dress and I'll be all set." We liked Bob because he was both different and unapologetic. "You take a day-old pork chop, stab it with a fork and soak it in some vinegar and you've got yourself some good eatin'," he'd say, fingering the feathery tip of his waist-length braid. Because of his strict upbringing and countless allergies, Bob's apartment was a testament to order and cleanliness. We figured that someone who carefully shampooed the lining of his work boots might briefly date our sister, but would never go so far as to marry her. Lisa couldn't be trained to scoot the food scraps off her soiled sheets, much less shake out the blanket and actually make the bed. I underestimated both his will and his patience. They had lived together for close to 3 years when I dropped by unannounced and found my sister standing at the sink with a sponge in one hand and a plate in the other. She still hadn't realized the all-important role of detergent, but she was learning. Bob eventually cut his hair and returned to college, abandoning his shovel for a career in corporate real estate. He was a likable guy. It was the marrying part that got to me. My sister's wedding was right up there with my recent colostomy in terms of 3-word phrases I hoped never to use. 3 weeks before the wedding, my mother called to say she had cancer. She'd gone to a doctor complaining about a ringing in her ear, and the resulting tests revealed a substantial tumor in her lung. "They tell me it's the size of a lemon," she said. "Not a tiny fist or an egg, but a lemon. I think they describe it in terms of fruit so as not to scare you, but come on, who wants a lemon in their lung? They're hoping to catch it before it becomes a peach or a grapefruit, but who knows, I sure as hell don't. 20-odd tests and they still haven't figured out what's wrong with my ear. I'm just hoping that whatever it isn't much larger than a grape. The cancer, though, I realize it's my own fault. I'm just sorry your father's still around to remind me of that fact every 15 goddamn seconds. My sister Amy was with me when my mother called. We passed the phone back and forth across my tiny New York kitchen and then spent the rest of the evening lying in bed, trying to convince each other that our mother would get better but never quite believing it. I'd heard of people who had survived cancer, but most of them claimed to get through it with the aid of whole grains and spiritual publications that encouraged them to sit quietly in a lotus position. They envisioned their tumors and tried to reason with them. Our mother was not the type to greet the dawn or cook with oats and barley. She didn't reason, she threatened. And if that didn't work, she chose to ignore the problem. We couldn't picture her joining a support group or trotting through the mall in a warm-up suit. 62 years old and none of us had ever seen her in a pair of slacks. I'm not certain why, but it seemed to me that a person needed a pair of pants in order to defeat cancer. Just as important, they needed a plan. They needed to accept the idea of a new and different future, free of crowded ashtrays and 5-gallon jugs of wine and scotch. They needed to believe that such a life might be worth living. I didn't know that I'd be able to embrace such an unrewarding future, but I hoped that she could. My brother, sisters, and I undertook a campaign to bolster her spirits and suggest new and exciting hobbies she might explore once she was cured and back on her feet. "It'll be great," I said. "You could, I don't know, maybe you could learn to pilot small planes or volunteer to hold crack babies. There are a lot of things an older person can do with their time rather than smoke and drink." "Please don't call me stoned on pot and tell me there are lots of things I can do with my life," she said. "I just got off the phone with your brother who suggested I open up a greyhound track. If that's what being high does for a person, then what I really need to do is start smoking marijuana, which would be a bit difficult for me since the last time I saw my right lung, it was lying in the bottom of a pan." In truth, her lungs were right where they'd always been. The cancer was too far advanced and she was too weak to survive an operation. The doctor decided to send her home while he devised a plan. The very word sounded hopeful to us. A plan. "The doctor has a plan," my sisters and I crowed to one another. "Right," my mother said. "He plans to golf on Saturday, sail on Sunday, and ask for my eyes, kidneys, and what's left of my liver the following Monday. That's his plan." We viewed it as a bad sign when she canceled her subscription to People magazine and took to buying her cigarettes in packs rather than cartons. She went through a jewelry box, calling my sisters to ask if they preferred pearls or gems. "Right now the rubies are in a brooch shaped like a candy cane, but you could probably get more money if you have them removed and just sell the stones." In her own way, she had already begun to check out, giving up on the plan before it was even announced. "But what about us?" I wanted to say. "Aren't we reason enough to carry on?" I thought of the unrelenting grief we had caused her over the years and answered the question myself. It was her hope to die before one of us landed in jail. "What's Amy planning on wearing to this little Pepsi commercial?" my mother asked, referring to the mountaintop ceremony. "Tell me it's not that wedding dress, please." Lisa had decided to be married in a simple cream-colored suit, the sort of thing one might wear to work on the day of their employee evaluation. Figuring that at least someone ought to look the part, Amy had the idea to attend the ceremony dressed in a floor-length wedding gown, complete with veil and train. In the end, she wound up wearing something my mother hated even more, a pink cocktail dress outfitted with detachable Lego mutton sleeves. It wasn't like my mother to care what anyone wore, but she used the topic to divert attention from what we came to refer to as her situation. If she'd had it her way, we would have never known about the cancer. It was our father's idea to tell us, and she had fought it, agreeing only when he threatened to tell us himself. Our mother worried that once we found out, we would treat her differently, delicately. We might feel obliged to compliment her cooking and laugh at all of her jokes, thinking always of the tumor she was trying so hard to forget. And that is exactly what we did. The knowledge of her illness forced everything into the spotlight and demanded that it be memorable. We were no longer calling our mother. Now we were picking up the telephone to call our mother with cancer. Bad day at work? All you had to do was say, "I am sorry I forgot to vacuum beneath the cushions of your very lovely, very expensive Empire sofa, Mrs. Wallman. I know how much it means to you. I guess I should be thinking of more important things than my mother's inoperable cancer." We weren't the ones who were sick, but still, the temptation was so great. Here we could get the sympathy without enduring any of the symptoms. And we deserved sympathy, didn't we? Speaking to our mother, we realized that any conversation might be our last, and because of that, we wanted to say something important. But what could one say that hadn't already been printed on millions of greeting cards and helium balloons? "I love you," I said at the end of one of our late-night phone calls. "I am going to pretend that I didn't hear that," she said. I heard a match strike in the background, the tinkling of ice cubes in a raised glass, and then she hung up. I had never said such a thing to my mother, and if I had it to do over again, I would probably take it back. Nobody ever spoke that way except Lisa. It was queer to say such a thing to someone unless you were trying to talk them out of money or into bed. Our mother had taught us this when we were no taller than pony kegs. I had known people who said such things to their parents, "I love you," but it always translated to mean, "I'd love getting off the phone with you." We gathered together for the wedding, which took place on a crisp, clear October afternoon. The ceremony was held upon a grassy precipice that afforded magnificent views of the surrounding peaks, the trees resplendent in fiery red and orange. It was easy to imagine, looking out over the horizon, that we were it, the last remaining people on the face of the earth. The others had been wiped out by disease and famine, but we had been chosen to fashion a new and better world. It was a pleasant thought until I pictured us foraging for berries and having to bathe in ice-cold streams. Bob's family, hardy and robust, could probably pull it off, but the rest of us would wither and die shortly after we'd run out of shampoo. My father wept openly during the ceremony. The rest of us studied his crumpled face and fought hard not to follow his example. What was this emotion? My sister was getting married to a kind and thoughtful man who had seen her through a great many hardships. Together they shared a deep commitment to Mexican food and were responsible, card-carrying members of the North American Caged Bird Society. The tacos and parrots were strictly between Lisa and Bob, but the rest of her belonged to us. Standing in a semicircle on top of that mountain, it became clear that while Lisa might take on a different last name, she could never escape the pull of our family. Marriage wouldn't let her off the hook even if she wanted it to. She could move to Antarctica, setting up house in an underground bunker, but still we would track her down. It was senseless to run. Ignore our letters and phone calls and we would invade your dreams. I'd spent so many years thinking marriage was the enemy that when the true danger entered our lives, I was caught completely off guard. The ceremony inspired a sense of loss directed not at Lisa, but at our mother. "No booze," she moaned. My mother staggered towards a buffet table, its retractable legs trembling beneath the weight of sparkling waters, sausage biscuits, and decaffeinated coffee. "No booze," Lisa had announced a week before the ceremony. "Bob and I have decided we don't want that kind of a wedding." "Which kind?" my mother asked. "The happy kind? You and Bob might be thrilled to death, but the rest of us will need some help working up the proper spirit." She didn't look much different than she had the last time I'd seen her. The chemotherapy had just begun and she'd lost at most maybe 5 pounds. A casual acquaintance might not have noticed any change at all. We did only because we knew, everyone on that mountaintop knew, that she had cancer, that she was going to die. The ceremony was relatively small, attended by both families and an assortment of Lisa's friends, most of whom we'd never met but could easily identify. These were the guests who never once complained about the absence of alcohol.
"Hey, I just want you to know that Colleen and I both love your sister Lisa so much."
The woman's face was moist with tears.
I know we've never been formally introduced, but would you mind if I gave you a big fat hug?
With the exception of Lisa, we were not a hugging people. In terms of emotional comfort, it was our belief that no amount of physical contact could match the healing powers of a well-made cocktail.
Hey, wait a minute. Where's my hug?
Colleen asked, rolling up her sleeves and moving in for the kill. I looked over my attacker's shoulder and watched as a woman in a floor-length corduroy skirt wrestled my mother into an affectionate headlock.
I heard what you're going through, and I know that you're frightened,
the woman said, looking down at the head of thinning gray hair she held clasped between her powerful arms.
You're frightened because you think you're alone.
I'm frightened, my mother wheezed, because I'm not alone, and because you're crushing what's left of my goddamn lungs.
The scariest thing about these people was that they were sober. You could excuse that kind of behavior from someone tanked up on booze, but most of them hadn't taken a drink since the Carter administration. I took my mother's arm and led her to a bench beyond the range of the other guests. The thin mountain air made it difficult for her to breathe, and she moved slowly, pausing every few moments. The families had taken a walk to a nearby glen, and we sat in the shade, eating sausage biscuits and speaking to one another like well-mannered strangers.
The sausage is good, she said. It's flavorful, but not too greasy.
Not too greasy at all. Still, though, it isn't dry.
Neither are the biscuits, she said. They're light and crisp, very buttery.
Very. These are some very buttery biscuits. They're flaky, but not too flaky. Not too flaky at all, she said.
We watched the path, awkwardly waiting for someone to release us from the torture of our stiff and meaningless conversation. I'd always been afraid of sick people, and so had my mother. It wasn't that we feared catching their brain aneurysm or accidentally ripping out their IV. I think it was their fortitude that frightened us. Sick people reminded us not of what we had, but of what we lacked. Everything we said sounded petty and insignificant. Our complaints paled in the face of theirs, and without our complaints, there was nothing to say. My mother and I had been fine over the telephone, but now, face to face, the rules had changed. If she were to complain, she risked being seen as a sick complainer, the worst kind of all. If I were to do it, I might come off sounding even more selfish than I actually was. This sudden turn of events had robbed us of our common language, leaving us to exchange the same innocuous pleasantries we'd always made fun of. I wanted to stop it, and so, I think, did she, but neither of us knew how. After the gifts had been opened, we returned to our rooms at the Econo Lodge, the reservations having been made by my father. We looked out the windows, past the freeway and into the distance, squinting at the charming hotels huddled at the base of other, finer mountains. This would be the last time our family was all together. It's so rare when one knowingly does something for the last time, the last time you take a bath, the last time you have sex or trim your toenails. If you knew you'd never do it again, it might be nice to really make a show of it. This would be it as far as my family was concerned, and it ticked me off that our final meeting would take place in such a sorry excuse for a hotel. My father had taken the liberty of ordering non-smoking rooms, leaving the rest of us to rifle through the dumpster in search of cans we might use as ashtrays.
"What more do you want out of a hotel?" he shouted, stepping out onto the patio in his underpants. "It's clean, they've got a couple of snack machines in the lobby, the TV's working, it's near the interstate. Who cares if you don't like the damn wallpaper? You know what your problem is, don't you?"
"We're spoiled!"
we shouted in unison.
We were not, however, cheap. We would have gladly paid for something better. No one was asking for room service or a heated swimming pool, just for something with a little more character. Maybe a motel with an Indian theme or one of the many secluded lodges that as a courtesy posted instructions on how to behave should a bear interrupt your picnic. Traveling with our father meant always having to stay at nationally known motor lodges and taking our meals only in fast food restaurants.
"What?" he'd ask. "Are you telling me you'd rather sit down at a table and order food you'd never tasted before?"
Well, yes, that was exactly what we wanted. Other people did it all the time, and most of them had lived to talk about it.
Bullshit! He'd shout. That's not what you want!
When arguing, it was always his tactic to deny the validity of our requests. If you wanted, say, a stack of pancakes, he would tell you not that you couldn't have them, but that you never really wanted them in the first place. I know what I want was always met with, no you don't! My mother never shared his enthusiasm for corporate culture, and as a result, they had long since decided to take separate vacations. She usually traveled with her sister, returning from Santa Fe or Martha's Vineyard with a deep tan, while my father tended to fish or golf with friends we had never met. The night before the wedding, we had gone to a charming lodge and eaten dinner with Bob's parents. The dining room had the feel of someone's home. Upon the walls hung pictures of deceased relatives, and the mantel supported aged trophies and a procession of hand-carved decoys. The night of the wedding, Lisa and Bob having left for their honeymoon, we were left on our own. My sisters, stuffed with sausage, chose to remain in their rooms, so I went with my parents and brother to a chain restaurant located on a brightly lit strip of highway near the outskirts of town. Along the way, we passed dozens of more attractive options, steakhouses boasting firelit dining rooms and clapboard cottages lit with discreet signs reading Home Cooking and None Better.
What about that place? My brother said. I've never tasted squirrel before. Hey, that sounds nice. Ha, my father said. You won't think it's so nice at 3 a.m. when you're hunched over the john, crapping out the lining of your stomach.
My mother wanted to go someplace that served drinks.
The Italian place. Let's go there.
My brother and I backed her up, and a short time later we found ourselves seated in a dimly lit restaurant. My father looking up at the waitress to shout,
Rare, do you know what that means? I want my steak the color of your gums.
Oh, Lou, give it a rest. My mother filled her wine glass and lit a cigarette.
What are you doing?
He followed his question with an answer.
You're killing yourself is what you're doing.
My mother lifted her glass in salute.
You've got that right, baby.
I don't believe this.
You might as well just put a gun to your head. No, I take that back. You can't blow your brains out because you haven't got any.
You should have known that when I agreed to marry you, she said.
Sharon, you haven't got a clue.
He shook his head in disgust. You open your mouth and the crap just flies. My mother had stopped listening years ago, but it was almost a comfort that my father insisted on business as usual, despite the circumstances. In him, she had found someone whose behavior would never vary. He had made a commitment to make her life miserable, and no amount of sickness or bad fortune would sway him from that task. My last meal with my parents would be no different than the first. Had we been at home, my mother would have fed him at 7 and waited until 10 or 11, at which time she and I would broil steaks. We would have put away several drinks by then, and if by chance the steaks were overcooked, she would throw them to the dog and start all over again. Before moving to New York, I had spent 2 months in Raleigh, painting one of my father's rental units near the university, and during that time our schedule never varied. Sometimes we'd eat in front of the television, and other nights we would set a place for ourselves at the table. I try recalling a single one of those evenings, wanting to take comfort in the details, but they are lost to me. Even my diary tells me nothing. 8 steaks with Mom. But which steaks? Porterhouse or New York Strip? What had we talked about, and why hadn't I paid attention? We returned to the motor lodge where my parents retired to their room, and the rest of us hiked to a nearby cemetery, a once ideal spot that now afforded an excellent view of the newly built Pizza Hut. Over the years, our mother had repeatedly voiced her desire to be cremated. We would drive past a small forest fire or observe the pillars of smoke rising from a neighbor's chimney, and she would crush her cigarette saying, "That's what I want right there." Do whatever you like with the remains. Sprinkle them into the ashtrays of a fine hotel. Give them to smart-ass children for Christmas. Hand them over to the Catholics to rub into their foreheads. Just make sure I'm cremated.
Oh, Sharon, my father would groan. You don't know what you want.
He'd say it as though he himself had been cremated several times in the past, but had finally wised up and accepted burial as the only sensible option. We laid our Econolodge bedspreads over the dewy grass of the cemetery, smoking joints and trying to imagine a life without our mother. If there was a heaven, we probably shouldn't expect to find her there. Neither did she deserve to roam the fiery tar pits of hell, surrounded for all eternity by the same shitheads who brought us strip malls and theme restaurants. There must exist some middle ground, a place where one was tortured on a daily basis but still allowed a few moments of pleasure, taken wherever they could find it. That place seemed to be Raleigh, North Carolina, so why the big fuss? Why couldn't she just stay where she was and not have cancer? That was always our solution, to go back in time. We discussed it the way others spoke of bone marrow transplants and radiation. We discussed it as though it were a viable option. A time machine. That would solve everything. I could almost see its panel of blinking lights, the control board marked with etched renderings of lumbering dinosaurs, and ending with Lisa's wedding. We could turn it back and view our mother as a young girl, befriend her then, before her father's drinking turned her wary and suspicious. See her working in the greeting card section of the drugstore and warn her not to drop out of school. Her lack of education would make her vulnerable, causing her to overuse the phrase, "Well, what do I know?" or "I'm just an idiot, but..." We could turn it back and see ourselves as babies, our mother stuck out in the country with no driver's license, wondering who to call should someone swallow another quarter or safety pin. The dial was ours, and she would be at our mercy, just as she always had been. Only this time we would pay attention and keep her safe. Ever since arriving at the Motor Lodge, we'd gone back and forth from one room to another, holding secret meetings and exchanging private bits of information. We hoped that by preparing ourselves for the worst, we might be able to endure the inevitable with some degree of courage or grace. Anything we forecasted was puny compared to the future that awaited us. You can't brace yourself for famine if you've never known hunger. It is foolish even to try. The most you can do is eat up while you still can, stuffing yourself, shoveling it in with both hands and licking clean the plates, recalling every course in vivid detail. Our mother was back in her room and very much alive, probably watching a detective program on television. Maybe that was her light in the window, her figure stepping out into the patio to light a cigarette. We told ourselves she probably wanted to be left alone. That's how stoned we were. We'd think of this later, each in our own separate way. I myself tend to dwell on the stupidity of pacing a cemetery, while she sat, frightened and alone, staring at the tip of her cigarette and envisioning herself, clearly now, in ashes. Naked. It is disconcerting to talk to someone on the phone and know that he is naked. Every now and then I might call a friend who says, "You caught me on the way to the shower," but that's different. The man at the nudist colony sounded as though he had been naked for years. Even his voice was tanned. All right then. Have you ever visited us before? No? Well, you're in for a real treat. We've got a heated pool, a sauna, jacuzzi, and a fully stocked pond for fishing. I'd be happy to send you a brochure. Let me just, get your information here. Where, I wondered, did he keep his pen? I just called for the brochure, wanting to give it as a joke to my brother Paul, a floor sander who, due to a recent polyurethane spill, had been discovered naked by the startled owners of the condominium in which he'd been working. Ever since he told me about it, I've been calling to suggest other nude activities he might enjoy. "I keep telling you it was a goddamn accident," he yells so loud I have to hold the phone away from my ear. "I had clean clothes down in the kitchen, motherfucker. I was just trying to get to them when..." Ignoring him, I plow ahead. "Or boating. You might like doing that naked."
There are plenty of things a person like you can do without having to wear clothes. There's no need to feel ashamed of your desires. If it feels good, do it. Isn't that what you young people like to say? I keep at it until he slams down the phone. This brochure will be just the thing to send him over the edge. The brochure pictures a swimming pool, the fully stocked pond, a sun deck, and the inevitable volleyball court. It reads, "Body acceptance is the idea. Nude recreation is the way. Bring your towels and suntan lotion and relax with us. You will experience a freedom of movement that cannot be felt with clothes. The freedom to be yourself." Included in the envelope is a calendar filled with mystifying events such as nude bowling night, the hobo slumgullion, and nudeween. Under the heading of what to bring, they list only towels, suntan lotion, and a smile. Last night I was in a foul mood and provoked Hugh into a fight, goading him until he left the bedroom shouting, "You're a big, fat, hairy pig." Big is something I can live with. Fat is open to interpretation. But when coupled with the word hairy, it begins to form a mental picture that is brought into sharp focus when united with the word pig. A big, fat, hairy pig. Well, I thought, pigs provide us with bacon and watch bands, and that's saying something. Were they able to press buttons and operate levers with their sharp hooves, they would have been sent into space long before monkeys. Being a pig isn't so bad. I wiped a driblet of snot from the tip of my snout and lay there feeling sorry for myself. If I were a nudist, Hugh's words wouldn't have hurt me as I would have accepted myself for who I am. This afternoon, after a half dozen false starts, I phoned the nudist colony to make a reservation. We don't use the word colony anymore because it's too spooky. No, what we have here are trailers. The smaller units run $30 a night, but if you want your own kitchen and bathroom, your only option is a double wide, which will run you an extra $75 a week. How is the word colony spooky, but not trailer or even nudist for that matter? I can let you have the front bedroom of the double wide. That's not booked yet. Front bedroom suggested the evidence of a back bedroom, which I was told would be rented out separately. I was still wrestling with the idea of a trailer, and when he introduced the possibility of a roommate, my vision blurred. A roommate at a nudist trailer park. I made my reservation and planned to arrive in 1 week. I called the nudist park again today and a woman answered. When asked if they provide sheets and pillows, she said,
"Yes, but no towels. You'll have to bring your own towels because we can't be doing that. Bedding, yes. Towels, no."
I asked if the trailer's kitchen was equipped, and she replied,
"Kind of."
"Does it kind of have a stove and refrigerator?"
"Oh, sure. There's a sink up there and probably some pans and so forth, but definitely no towels. You'll have to pack your own because we can't be running back and forth like that. We haven't got the time for that kind of thing."
I told her I understood perfectly.
"A lot of folks think we keep a nice, fluffy stack of towels out by the pool for their own private use. But we don't do that. Not here. Not anymore."
I truly had gotten the message.
"Of course, sometimes a person might come in for the day and leave their towel behind by accident. But we put that towel in the lost and found box in case they come back looking for it. You can't use those towels because they're not clean and they don't belong to you. Wouldn't be right. And if it was lotion, I might say, 'Oh, go ahead and use it. I'll do your back.' But not towels. No way. You'll have to bring your own."
I underlined the word towels on my list of things to pack and placed question marks beside everything else. I arrived at the nudist park early this afternoon, the cab driver pulling up to the clubhouse in a light rain. He'd been very nervous on the ride over. "I'm not here to judge," he said. "Hell, I give rides to all kinds of people, even drunks. Whatever floats your boat, partner." I collected my bags and entered a low, clapboard building where 5 fully dressed senior citizens sat hugging themselves against the cold and watching the local news on a color television set bolted to a high shelf. On the screen, a weatherman pointed to a map studded with frowning suns. The inhabitants of the room leaned forward in their chairs, biting the ridges of their clenched fists and groaning when confronted with the words "cold front." They booed the weatherman. I set down my suitcase and approached the front desk.
He did this!
An elderly man pointed his crooked finger in my direction.
Brought this nastiness with him down from the lakes!
You from the lakes?
The woman behind the counter asked. The corners of her mouth hung so low they grazed the line of her jaw. She narrowed her eyes upon my suitcase as if expecting it might bluster across the floor, packed as it was with storm clouds and unseasonable winds. I don't know anything about any lakes. There was a rising panic in my voice. It was hot and sunny when I left New York this morning. Really, it was. It turned cool around Scranton, but I didn't even get off the bus. It's the truth. You can ask the driver.
Well, it's supposed to clear by tomorrow afternoon, but if it doesn't, I'll know where to find you.
The woman pointed out the window.
It's that trailer there with the orange trim. Front bedroom. That's what I've got you down for.
You mean the one with the rust-colored band?
You call it rust? I say it's orange. It's the one with the picnic table in the front yard.
Without meaning to, I seemed to have offended her. I asked where I might find the key to my trailer and heard a round of muffled laughter coming from the far corners of the room.
Key?
She acted as though I had requested a prayer rug or life-size statue of Buddha.
We don't believe in locked doors. Not here we don't. Maybe where you come from, people barricade themselves behind closed doors. But here we have no reason.
She placed her elbows upon the countertop and framed her face between her fists.
We don't lock our doors because, unlike certain other people, we have nothing to hide.
My trailer's main room is paneled with artificial walnut planks, and the low, fiberglass-tiled ceiling is stained with watermarks. A linoleum floor separates the kitchen area from the carpeted living room, which is furnished with a worn, gold velvet sofa and two matching easy chairs that face a low table bearing the scuff marks of a now-absent television set. My bedroom, like that of my potential roommates, is cell-like in both its size and simplicity, furnished only with a bed and a small chest of drawers that easily accommodates the little I brought with me. By the time I'd unpacked and put away my groceries, it was early evening and the rain had stopped. After staring at the spot where the television used to be, I took a walk past the clubhouse and up into the park's more established neighborhoods. These were mobile homes that had been solidly grounded upon carefully manicured lots, many with built-on decks made of pine and redwood. Some of the trailers had been sided to resemble log cabins, and others were fronted by shingled, A-framed entrance halls. The homeowners' names were displayed on wooden plaques along with slogans such as, "Bear with us," or "Smile if you talk naked." A trailer door opened and a young woman stepped out, leading a child who beat upon her legs with a wooden spoon. The woman was topless, and her breasts hung like two knee socks, each stuffed with a single orange. I knew when I signed up that I would encounter exposed breasts, but this being my first pair, I reacted with alarm. She wore her hair in a neglected shag and scolded the child for a moment or two before gathering him up in her arms and burying her sharp-featured face into his stomach. Topless. She was topless, walking the streets of what amounted to her neighborhood. The boy howled with pleasure and then rapped her over the head with his spoon.
He's at that age,
the woman said, and I nodded in agreement, pretending to recall the first time I had tweaked my mother's nipple while standing in the front yard of our trailer. It took a few drinks before, drawing the curtains of my double-wide, I was able to remove my shirt and shoes. The table was littered with beer cans by the time I finally stepped out of my briefs. Naked. I was drunk and naked. It's begun to thunder and rain is beating down upon the metal roof of my trailer. 10 o'clock, and from what I can see, everyone's lights are out for the evening. I've been reading over the list of rules handed to me this afternoon by the matron behind the front desk.
Conduct. We are a family park and expect your conduct to reflect the moral standards of a family campground. Towels. Carry a towel with you at all times and please sit on your towel for sanitary reasons.
Towels. It suddenly made sense. Noticing the wide variety of short curly hairs beside me on the sofa, I leapt up and fetched a towel that from this moment on will never leave my underside.
Photography. Cameras and camcorders are permitted only by special permission of the management. Any photography equipment not approved by the management will be taken from you. Prior written permission must be obtained from any person being photographed. Alcohol. Alcoholic beverages may be consumed only in moderation. Intoxication will not be permitted on the grounds. Pool etiquette. Take a soap shower before entering the pool or the hot tub. Dress. We dress or undress for comfort. When using our recreational facilities, you must be nude. Intimate apparel, bathing suits, and intimate body jewelry are inappropriate on our grounds. You must be nude in the pool, hot tub, and shower.
What, I wonder, is intimate apparel and body jewelry? Doesn't the word lose meaning when everyone is nude? I know it's probably against the rules, but I can't shake the hint of sexual excitement I'm feeling. It's not an erection, just a tingling sensation in the tip of my penis. Outside of the bathtub or an occasional doctor's visit, the only time I'm naked is when I've talked someone into having sex with me. I keep expecting some guy to walk out of the bathroom saying, "So what do you plan on doing with the prize money?" It feels silly to wander around my trailer this way, and I realize that it has long been my habit to stretch my t-shirt over my knees while sitting alone at a table. I'm also used to pulling my pants above my navel and tightening my belt in order to diminish my gut. Jangling the keys in my pocket, thoughtlessly gnawing at the collars of my shirts, these things are lost to me now. It feels dangerous to drink a cup of hot coffee, and twice in the last hour, I've hopped up to brush glowing cigarette ash off of what I once considered to be my private parts. I woke this morning to a fog so thick I couldn't see the picnic table in my front yard. From the sky to the ground, everything was the exact same shade of gray. It wasn't until early evening that the weather finally cleared. At 6 o'clock, I looked out my window to see a naked couple strutting across the grounds with a pair of tennis rackets in their hands. The man carried himself as though he were dressed in a fine suit, his stride confident and purposeful, while the woman trotted along behind him wearing a sun visor, knee socks, and sneakers. These were the first outdoor nudists I had seen, and I threw on my clothes and followed them to the pavilion, where I pulled a book from my pocket and pretended to read. The man had an ample stomach and a broad, dimpled ass that jiggled and swayed as he leapt about the court, attempting to return his partner's serves. They played for no more than 5 minutes before he placed his hands on his knees, released a mouthful of bile onto the grass, and called it quits. They left the court and I followed them into the clubhouse, where the man stepped into the bathroom, returning 10 minutes later with a bright red ring around his ass. Here, I thought, was a real nudist. There was a tuft of toilet paper, just slight, clinging to his bottom, and when the woman pointed it out to him, he ran his hand along his crack and casually shrugged, as though it were no more significant than a dab of mayonnaise on his lip. I went tonight to the clubhouse to watch TV, and sat there alone for 20 minutes or so when Jackie, an older woman, traipsed naked from the bathroom, asking if I'd care to join her in the sauna. I had never before visited a sauna and wasn't quite sure what it involved. Did I need a bar of soap?
A towel, silly. All you need is a towel. Now get your clothes off and get out there. I'll be waiting for you.
Because it was delivered as an order, it seemed useless to argue. Sooner or later, I would have to appear naked, and this seemed as good a time as any. I ran back to my trailer, grabbed the towel, and lowered my pants, thinking I might inspect my ass in the mirror, but knowing that if I did, I'd never leave the house again. I swabbed myself with a washcloth just for good measure and returned to the clubhouse where I undressed in the bathroom, folding my clothes and piling them neatly on the countertop. It's all right, I thought. This is a bathroom. It's natural to be naked in a bathroom. It was not, however, quite so natural to leave the bathroom and walk past the tables and chairs of the clubhouse. Other people did it with no problem whatsoever, and look at them. Jackie had breezed through the room, and I'd looked at her as though she were a goat that had wandered into a hotel lobby. Now it was my turn.
I tried viewing it as a privilege, and when that didn't work, I threw the towel over my shoulder, closed my eyes, and ran straight into the bookcase. The sauna, a squat wooden hut, was located beside the pool. A stifling antechamber led to a sweltering hellhole, heated by a smokeless cauldron filled with white-hot rocks. Jackie sat upon a wooden shelf, mopping at the sweat that ran down her breasts, over her considerable stomach, and collected in a puddle beneath her childlike shaved vagina. She aimed a squeeze bottle towards the cauldron and released a stream of fragrant water upon the rocks, causing the chamber to grow even hotter.
You like that? It's eucalyptus. Eucalyptus is a healing ointment, very big back in ancient Greece and Egypt. It opened the sinuses of Socrates and King Ramses II, allowing them to concentrate on more important things like democracy and snakes. It frees the mind, eucalyptus. I get some wild thoughts here in the sauna. I don't mind telling you that. Thoughts like, well, I don't know, thoughts like, well, what if everyone in the world were allowed one wish, but in order to get it, it meant they'd had to crawl around on their hands and knees for the rest of their life. That's a real puzzler, isn't it? If you wanted to be rich, you'd have to crawl around in your palace just like a baby with your mink coat dragging the floor. World peace? A cure for cancer? An end to hunger and suffering? What'll it be, Dave? Huh? What's your wish?
The eucalyptus had obviously not cleared my mind the way it had hers. Still, though, once the question had been introduced, I found it impossible not to think about it. If I could have the face and body of my dreams, what good would it do me if I had to walk around like an animal? Maybe if I were to wish for happiness, I wouldn't mind crawling. But what kind of a person would I be if I were naturally happy? I've seen people like that on inspirational television shows, and they scare me. Why did I have to think about this in the first place? I looked over at Jackie's round, glistening face, her hands folded over her belly like a wizened, patient genie. If I had one wish, I'd wish for an unlimited amount of wishes, I said. She shook her head in a way that suggested she had heard this answer countless times before.
Don't get greedy on me, Dave. You only get one wish.
The room filled with steam, and in my woozy state, it occurred to me that this woman might actually possess some musty supernatural power. The circumstances were so bizarre that maybe she had been sent to grant me my one true desire. I thought of having my mother back, but often these are trick wishes. I might ask for my mother and receive an urnload of talking ashes that would complain bitterly at the sight of her son racing back and forth across a room like a bloodhound. Curing disease is a nice idea, but if we all got one wish, surely some enthusiastic 14-year-old would take care of that. I'd wish, I said. I'd wish that I could fly.
Fair enough.
Jackie scratched a mosquito bite on her upper arm and sighed.
I have to go away this weekend, and I'm definitely not looking forward to it at all.
But what about my wish, I said.
What about it?
I asked her to explain the rule concerning body jewelry and intimate attire.
Clothing-wise, you're talking about thongs and negligees. Anything that might be showy or suggestive. And the jewelry? Well, it's all right to wear rings and necklaces and so forth. They just don't want any... Geez, how can I put this? Well, if you have earrings, they should be in your ears. Get it? It's against the rules to have any pierced thingies. You know, either up top or down near.
It struck me as odd that the subject had made her so uncomfortable. With sweat pooling just south of her shaved vagina, this grandmother could sit naked with a strange man, but not for the life of her use the words breast or penis. We all just had thingies, mine simmering in my lap like a boiled shrimp. Every few minutes, Jackie leaned forward to shoot another stream of eucalyptus-laced water into the cauldron, and I found myself too weak to stop her. Sweat had blurred my vision, and the room had grown so unbearably hot that I could practically hear the blood bubbling in my veins. It occurred to me that I was going to die. My heart had been steamed, and I'd released so many gallons of sweat that my towel now weighed more than I did.
Out with you! Go on now, quick, scoot!
I left the sauna, spread out my towel,
and laid on the concrete patio beside the pool. It was a clear evening, chilly, but the air felt good. I heard a door slam and watched as Jackie waddled back to the clubhouse. She didn't see me lying there, and I saw no point in calling out to her. I'd be fine on my own, lying naked on the ground and thinking things over. Because of the pleasant weather, the tarp had been taken from the swimming pool. It is a posted rule that you must be naked not only in the pool, but also in the area surrounding it. This struck me as harsh. I stripped off my t-shirt and there I was, naked. Naked in broad daylight, surrounded by strangers who rolled from their backs to their stomachs, leafing through the pages of their books and magazines. The upswing was that I didn't have to look at myself. On the other side of the pool, a stocky, handsome young man moved from his lounge chair to the sauna, to the hot tub, into the pool, and back to his chair. He was someone who had come in just for the day and seemed determined to get his $20 worth. I admired his ass, which was plump and unblemished, high and firm enough to support the first prize trophy I'd mentally awarded him for outstanding physical achievement. Returning naked from the sauna this evening, I passed a group of senior citizens who had gathered to watch a game show on the clubhouse TV.
"Ask for an E,"
someone shouted at the screen.
"I mean, ask for a C."
The speaker was a rowdy, white-haired woman with wrinkled, sun-cured skin, the color and texture of a blonde raisin. She wore nothing but a pair of bedroom slippers and a cardigan sweater she draped over her shoulders.
"I wish the show was naked."
The woman absentmindedly ran her fingers over the tabletop.
"It would be so much better that way, don't you think? They could take all the money the host spent on clothes and make the prizes even bigger and better. I could play the nude version and make enough to, I don't know, maybe I'd have someone dredge me a lake and fill it with boats."
She scratched at her arm, leaving white tracks that quickly faded, the skin resuming its natural color. I like the idea of that. Filming two separate versions of any given program, one clothed and the other tailored to capture what the network saw as its vast nudist audience. "Do I have to?" Peter Jennings would ask. This is Friday, and I awoke to a loud, grinding noise that turned out to be the owner's grandson circling my trailer on a riding lawnmower. He made several rotations before his grandmother ran up shouting,
"What are you, an idiot out here mowing the grass this way? For God's sake, boy, lay a towel down on that seat."
I went to the pool this morning and watched as a man removed his colostomy bag and taped a sheet of plastic over the hole before entering the water. I was thinking of how uncomfortable he must feel, and then turned to see a very old man who walked with a crutch and had no penis. His testicles were large and hairless, but where the penis should have been, there was only a small cavity. He noticed my staring and said only,
"Hot enough for you?"
I spent my early afternoon in a t-shirt, wandering the grounds and noticing the great number of people who rarely visit the clubhouse or recreation areas. Here were men and women kneeling in their gardens and operating weed eaters, doing the same things other homeowners do, but without the benefit of clothing. A man lit a charcoal fire in his backyard grill. He had protected his chest with an apron reading, "World's Greatest Chef," and used his spatula to startle a fly off his ass. Nudist life was just as mundane as any other, perhaps even more so as its practice demands that you never leave the grounds. The clothed world was out there, just beyond the front gate. They had restaurants there and movie theaters, a wide variety of distractions my neighbors had surrendered in exchange for the opportunity to grill chicken breasts in the nude. Obviously, I was missing something other than my pants. I'd hear people say, "Why go into town for lunch when we can stay here and be naked?" A person might enjoy golf or fishing, but that doesn't stop him from visiting a department store or a Chinese restaurant. When forced to go into town, the costumed nudists appear ornery and uncomfortable, like cats stuffed into little outfits for the sake of a wacky photograph. They claw at their buttons and zippers, their eyes wild and desperate. Because clothing doesn't interest them, most of these people are liable to wear anything. Stripes with checks,
pants three sizes too large or small. It simply doesn't matter to them. I'm wondering if it isn't their complete inability to throw together an outfit that turned these people nudist in the first place. Coming here from New York, it is heartening to walk into a room and know you're not being judged by your clothes. Still, though, as bad a dresser as I am, anything beats being judged by my character. This is Sunday, and looking out my bedroom window, I've noticed that a lot of today's visitors have spent the morning in church. Men, women, and children stand beside their cars, stripping off their sober costumes. The suit jackets and dresses are carefully folded and placed into back seats. This would be a terrible place to get locked out of your car, as the nearest coat hanger is probably a good 15 miles away. One of today's visitors was a Presbyterian minister, a plump, freckle-faced man with Daffy Duck tattooed on his ass. He wore it with a swagger, calling attention to a body part the Lord had clearly not blessed with muscle tone or unblemished skin. The duck's beak was distended, and he appeared to be picking at a rash of strawberries. This was the first day I'd left the house completely naked. The deck and sunning corral were filled to capacity, and I sat next to a slim woman in her early 50s. The woman spoke about a nudist resort in Arizona that charges only $5 a night for camping privileges.
And get this. They even pick you up at the airport and drive you to the grounds free of charge. It's a marvelous place. And the people? I mean to say there are some great naked people out in Arizona. And don't let anyone tell you any different.
I listened to her for a good 10 minutes before realizing that she was missing her left nipple. Not the breast, just the nipple. The surgeons had done an excellent job and the scar was slight, resembling a short length of fishing wire. Had she been the first nudist I'd met, I would have noticed it immediately, but part of feeling at ease with my own nudity involved not noticing it in others. Nudism didn't cause me to love my body. It simply allowed me to accept my position in what is clearly the scheme of things.
There are some sweet, naked people in Arizona, and they'll drive you to the campgrounds free of charge.
The woman spoke again, and I saw then that she had shaved all her pubic hair except for a brief, Hitler-style mustache. The exposed, lotion-coated vagina resembled one of those shiny plastic coin purses given away by banks and car dealers, and carried only by the very young or very old. The phrase, keep the change, came to mind. I've been here for almost a week and still haven't figured out this shaving business. It is common to see men with 5 o'clock shadows on their faces, but fresh, bleeding razor nicks on their bald testicles. Is it done to expedite the search for ticks? Or are these men and women shaving away the gray in the hope that they might appear younger? Clothed, it is easy to ignore the fact that we are all just animals, moving alone or in a herd formation. Whether we're running towards a bank or a choice spot beside the pool, it makes no difference. This was my last day. I'd planned to take a cab to the bus station but was offered a ride by Jackie. This was the first time in a week that I'd had to get dressed. Clothing was no longer optional. Now it was mandatory, and I found myself resenting it. Turn your back on a pair of pants and things can get nasty. She dropped me off at the bus station with 20 minutes to spare, and I raced up and down the street, passing college students in baggy knee-length shorts and bank tellers wearing navy blue suits. Every outfit resembled a costume designed to reveal the aspirations of the wearer. The young man on the curb would like to make the first Olympic skateboarding team. The girl in the plastic skirt longs to live in a larger town. I found myself looking at these people and thinking, I know what you look like naked. I can tell by your ankles and the tightness of your belt, the flush of your face, the hair sprouting from your collar, the way your pants hang off those bony hips, you can't hide it from me. It was as though I'd received the true version of the X-ray specs I'd ordered as a child. These glasses were advertised in the back pages of comic books and promised the ability to see through clothing. I'd counted the days until they arrived,
and was clinically disappointed to discover that I'd been cheated. These were black plastic frames supporting cardboard lenses. The eyeballs were rendered to appear bloodshot, and the pupils were tiny peepholes backed by plain red acetate. The glasses, when worn, gave me the look of someone both enthused and exhausted by what he saw. They suggested the manic weariness inherent in their promise, capturing the moment when the sheen wears off and your newfound gift becomes something closely resembling a burden.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks presentation of Naked, written by David Sedaris and performed by the author and Amy Sedaris. Produced and directed by Maya Thomas. Text abridged by Kim Grunenfelder and Maya Thomas. Original music by Stan Harrison. Production coordinated by Daniel Metcalf. This tape was recorded at Merlin Studio, New York. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Zacuto Audio.
What the hell do you think you're doing taking rides from strangers? What if I was to have a pistol or switchblade knife? You couldn't fight off a house cat, and don't bother telling me otherwise, because I know your type, Mr. Weisenheimer. Where are your people?
Oh, God.
That sounds great. That's great, Amy.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.